I want to rattle the walls.
Okay.
Loud as we can say this. And I want you in, and I want 3, 2, 1, let's go from the crowd, the gallery. All right. 3, 2, 1, let's go! Ladies and gentlemen, we are ready for day 2 of the PBE podcast panel discussions at GeoGolf 2024. What's your first GeoGolf, James Hawkins? What was the first one you got to go to?
Man, the first one I'd say was actually like more like 8 years ago. But I really wasn't working the Gulf. I was mainly working in West Texas.
Yeah, eight years ago.
I did come to see what it was like, and now I've been coming. This is my third one, so I've been coming more regular now.
And you're helping a ton out on this one. A lot of the pre stuff here, working the booth or working the front desk. John Cassiano put a lot of time and effort into this event, and then gearing up for it, we kind of did a pre-podcast thing talking about it, and we just kind of always had this concept that it's about investing it back into your community as a professional at the end of the day. Like, that's where success really is for people who want a future in whatever it is. It doesn't matter. It's not just oil and gas. Whatever your industry is, whatever your passion is, you got to invest back into it. That's why these events are here, and there's such value in these talks and the data that you're sharing as a business owner of what you're discovering and how you're using it. There's so much value here, and we were just talking about, you know, how do you get that to that next generation? How do you get them to understand that we're all busy? We've all been there. You know, we have the kids, we have our young career path, but it's so important to get in there and rub shoulders with everybody, meet people, meet new folks, meet new ideas. And that's why this happens. You agree?
Oh, absolutely.
How long have you been investing in your own career, Mr. Toner?
Well, I graduated as a geologist in 1989 in Nottingham in the UK.
Wow.
It's 35 years now. Yeah.
And you instantly just got right into the societies, right into... Well, industry.
You know, I started off working in the field. So I spent my first year working in Yemen, in South Yemen, working for Total at the well site in the Hadramaut Valley, flying into Aden and then into Mukalla. And I had no idea that it was so dangerous, otherwise I would never have gone. But but it was a fantastic experience, you know.
Wow.
And then I went on to work in Kenya and then Angola and then Congo.
This in your 20s?
Yeah, jeez. Straight out of school. And then it wasn't really until I moved here to the United States in 24 years ago now, in 2000, and I immediately joined the Houston Geological Society. In fact, I chaired the Northsiders group for 7 years. And so I was, you know, very involved in getting speakers in, and that was a very enriching experience, you know, talking about giving back and getting involved, you know. So,
man, that was cool. Got a little bit of your background too. Barry, please introduce yourself.
So I'm Barry Reva. I've been in the industry since 1981, so 43 years, and I never thought I'd be in the industry that long. And,
really?
You know, I've spent my whole career on the Gulf Coast. I got out of graduate school and I went to Denver because everybody would want to work up in Denver. And nobody would have me. My father said, well, why don't you go to Houston? And I'm like, it's so hot. But I went down to Houston and got 3 job offers and been working ever since.
In Houston?
Well, pretty much in Lafayette, Louisiana.
Wow.
And Corpus Christi.
Wow. Where'd you get your degrees?
Well, from... Hofstra University on Long Island and the University of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania.
Oh, the East Coast, Appalachia Mountains and all that.
Right? Yeah, I'm one of those bad Yankees. I came and I stayed, as they say.
Traitor.
But I really enjoy the industry, and you know, you had asked about the first, before it was called GeoGolf, it was GCAGS, and I've been going to those meetings probably since 1982 or 1983, and they really mean a lot for networking.
Well, so the panel discussion's about the future of exploration, So I'm obviously going to dig back into your history and think, you know, what would have been the future of exploration for you when you got into the industry 40 years ago, right? What did that look like, and what did it actually become? You know, where, how do we learn from that? How do we gain more information and knowledge about what's to come? But first, James Hawkins, please introduce who you're working for and introduce yourself.
All right, my name is James Hawkins. I work for Core Geologic. I do geology consulting, petrophysics consulting, thing, and geomechanics. I've been working for them for the past 4 years. You know, just helping, working in all basins and all in the U.S.
Nice.
So pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, we met because you put together a short course in Midland on FMI logs.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Interpretation.
Yeah.
Image logs.
Yeah, image logs, and really opened my eyes up to the petrophysical world. So you're, is that pretty much a good, like your key role is petrophysics at Core Geologic?
I'm more of a, I'm senior technical advisor. So I advise clients on best routes to go. Like, do they need a logging program? Do they need a, do they need to evaluate a resource? Do they, you know, do they want to look in an area, you know, exploration, development, all aspects of prospecting, both conventional and conventional.
I got
and, you know, you talk about exploration, and that kind of opens it up to, I see more conventional exploration starting to pop up. More people are looking at conventional rock.
Oh, yeah.
And getting away from the, you know, the unconventional. Because,
that's
you know, you cycle through that oil so fast, you got to keep drilling to maintain your production. But
yeah.
Conventional, there's still a lot of untapped resources out there.
And they'll kind of hang in there for a little longer, huh?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Barry, what's, what do you do now?
So for... the last 28 years, I've been in business for myself, a company called Icarus Oil and Gas, and I look for drilling opportunities on the Gulf Coast, and then I solicit participants for the projects, and we get them drilled.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
I don't operate. I don't want that responsibility, so I always find an operator. An operator is the company that deals with the day-to-day headaches in the state and federal regulatory bodies.
That's right. That's right, and we know it well. And Mr. Toner, of course, please introduce your company and what you're doing today.
Sure. Yeah, I'm the Chief Executive Officer at Diversified Well Logging, and we're a measurements company that's focused on robotics to improve the collection of rock while drilling and providing quantitative answers in order to improve drilling completion production economics.
Talk about the future, huh? Robotics. That's perfect. That's perfect. Let's talk about the demand, though. The first thing, kind of topic I had written out, energy transition. You hear that? The idea of oil demand in the future. If we have a future here as geologists, geoscientists, trying to continue to unlock oil and hydrocarbons efficiently and get that energy to support whatever the transition is, because that's the reality of the transition. It's supported by the oil and gas industry and the efficient energy we do have. What do you think of the demand as a whole in the future of exploration, but the demand of oil in the next 40 years?
Well, I mean, I you know, Dr. John Olson and at the luncheon meeting on Tuesday showed us some interesting figures where I think it was back in the late 1800s, we were consuming 32 exajoules of energy. And today we're consuming 650 exajoules of energy. Population has increased to 8.1 billion and is forecasted to grow to 10 billion in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years.
Whoa.
So, you know, everyone's energy hungry. We consume, even though we only have a population of 350 million, we consume a sixth of the world's energy. And people want to live like us. They want to enjoy the benefits that energy provides, you know, bringing people out of energy poverty. So yeah. There's only going to be more energy demand, right? And it was interesting on that same graph, he showed that, you know, wood back in the late 1800s was a significant source of energy. And it's been largely replaced by other fossil fuels, coal, natural gas, oil. But yet, the amount of wood that's currently being consumed is more than in the 1800s because overall the energy demand is higher. So whilst, you know, certainly, we're going to see more nuclear. We're probably going to see, more renewables, wind, yeah, solar. We're going to need more oil and gas, which is, it's an interesting time. But the planet's energy hungry, and a geoscientist, are they in a good position to provide that energy source?
Interesting. You have a similar feel or a kind of a advocate to something else?
I have a somewhat similar feel. Okay. You know, the interesting thing is when I was born, the world's population was about 2.3 billion. And now we're at about 8, and it's going to go to 9. Wow. And, you know, rough statistics are about half the people have all the energy they need, and the other half want the energy. So energy demand is only going to increase with time. As far as energy transition, I think as human beings, we have a lot of hubris to think that we can declare a transition and make it happen. I hope we can. It's an interesting experiment,
yeah,
because the government didn't legislate us to stop using wood to use coal or to stop using coal and use oil. But, you know, the interesting thing is we need to use more dense forms of energy, and nuclear is the densest form we have.
Okay.
And the bottom line is, as the population goes to 9 billion, you can't all wear cotton and linen. You got to have synthetics to wear, you know, and guess where that come from? They come from oil and gas. And I think ultimately oil and gas is going to be more valuable as a material than as a source of fuel.
Wow. So that's a long economic range. Yeah, an economic transition of energy, of oil and gas, right, in the future. There's the right demand of it, and this idea of energy transition or transformation, but energy is going to go from, maybe it does change from oil and gas predominantly, but oil and gas is then just going to get recycled into all the other great things that oil and gas does for humanity. All right, what are your thoughts, Mr. Hawkins?
I mean, my thoughts are exactly what, you know, these gentlemen here just described. But also, you think about it, oil is fractioned into lots of different things, so it's not just energy. We use it for all kinds of other things, for, you know, for clothing, for glasses, for recovered asphalt that we take out of the oil, the tar, we put that on roads. I mean, there's so many other utilities. Right. I just don't think that it's not gonna be a fast transition. It's gonna be slow, but we'll always still have a need for it.
I've read where we use oil and gas for over 6,000 products, and the medical community is entirely dependent on us. Where yeah. When you used to go to the hospital, everything was made out of glass. Now it's all made out of plastic. Medicines are delivered via plastic. It's just amazing, amazing.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's got to be some kind of devil's advocate to this, but you know, I can't think of it. I can maybe make something up, but you know, I certainly can't think of something real logical. It's, you know, the demand's just not going to really be there.
You know, one of the complaints is about CO2, and society wants to pin it on the oil and gas business, but right, really it needs to pin it on itself, because if everyone stopped using oil and gas, we wouldn't sell it anymore. And so really it's a societal problem. And the interesting thing about CO2 is the history of it in the world's atmosphere is, when you go back billions of years, during that highlight when plants first came to be, parts per million was over 6,000, and it got as low as almost 200, which a lot of biologists feel is the critical point where green plants couldn't sustain themselves.
Start starving out.
And right, now it's on the rise again in the 300 level.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, going back to sort of early school biology, you know, photosynthesis, I mean, carbon dioxide is plant food, and so the planet is actually, it's never been as green as it has been in the last, you know, 50 years. We're actively greening. There's more plant life than ever before, which is contrary to what you, I think, perceive in mainstream media. But nevertheless, I think the issues around fossil fuels in terms of the perception across the world is going to be very difficult to change. You know, I think we just have to embrace that and move on. I think carbon sequestration offers a great opportunity to address that issue. You know, so future of exploration is going to be around, you know, those sort of things, you know, reducing the carbon footprint. That does not mean that we don't continue to use fossil fuels. It just means we need to use other methods to redress the carbon footprint.
Yeah, no, I think we worn out demand. I definitely think we're good on that. It makes sense what we're talking about. Now, there's the idea of peak oil, right? Back in the day, it was like the planet doesn't have enough. Now we realize, okay, that's obviously not the case. The planet has more than enough. The idea of peak oil is now the demand. You know, peak oil of how we use oil is going to get to some peak and then it'll start falling, and that's somewhere off in the future. So we don't really need to worry about that right now. What I'd like to focus on is the exploration tactics moving forward. So we know we have it. We know we have a lot of good places to go for it. We know, like the Permian taught us, at the right prices, you can go a lot of places and make it work, make it economic. And, you know, we know the target's there, but when prices are kind of hanging down, even at these 80s, which is interesting, back in the day, someone would have said 80s. That's amazing. You know, we must have 1,000 rigs, you know, running or whatever, because $80 oil, but we're at $80 oil and the rigs are dropping. So this $80 oil is not quite enough to keep the rigs going and keep all this out there. So what do we need to do as far as a strategy, I guess, a tactic for exploration? How can the future get better in exploration?
Well, I think that we're right now trying to do efficiencies, right? Speed up the drilling process, speed up everything so we can save money and we can get oil out of the ground. But I think where we really need to focus is actually on recovery. If you look at the shales, we're only getting 8% recovery out of the shale formations. Mm-hmm. You know, there's technology that we could try to develop, and a lot of people aren't really developing technology. They're just drilling wells. They're not really trying different things, trying to see how much resource can we get out of the rock. That should be a strategy that we look forward to, is how do we get more oil out?
That's interesting.
How do we become more efficient?
And I think we're getting more efficient personnel-wise with the software that we're using. Hmm. When I first started in the industry, there were 50 people in the department that I was in at a big oil company, and 50 of us were working in the Gulf of Mexico, and it might take me 2 weeks or a month to contour 10 square miles of seismic data.
Wow.
And now one person or two people in my own shop, we can contour and interpret probably a couple of hundred miles of data in a week. And you know, there's fewer and fewer people in the industry. People my age and a little bit younger are retiring. There aren't as many young people coming into the industry,
right.
But there's new software out that will do what I still do by hand. It will do automatically. It will find breaks in the data and faults, and that program undoubtedly will be more efficient at finding all the little discontinuities that I can't even keep track of. And it'll be up to one person to maybe look at 500 square miles of data and to decide where it's valid and where it's invalid.
Sure.
And then there are other programs that look at the rock content based on all different parameters geophysically that are very, very hard to see. And so the programs will continually evolve, and they'll need less people. The oil industry, when I was growing up in the New York metro area, all the big companies were centered up there. But society wanted cheap oil, so what did they do? One by one, they all left the New York metro area and came down to Houston, Texas, where everything was cheaper. So their salaries and their overhead decreased as opposed to being up north.
Wow.
And the number of personnel are always getting smaller and smaller. Dave even mentioned, in the systems that he used, and I don't want to steal his thunder, I mean, you might have had two or three mudloggers on a well, somebody to catch samples, somebody to look at it, and someone falling asleep. And now they can do part of that automatically, which blows me away.
More time to sleep.
More time to sleep.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the data side of it is really important, and staying relevant. I mean, there's a few things that spring to mind just in conversations this week. I was speaking to Geomark, and they were saying that Graham Spence, and he was saying that they have 80,000 oils in their global database, right? And they have recently been taking some of those oils, which spans, back from 30, 40 years. And because technology has developed in terms of what you can measure on those oils, some of the higher end GCs and spectrometers, which were not available back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're taking existing material and re-examining it using new technology, which is providing new insights. And even just on a personal level, I mean, during the pandemic, because I could, I was working from home, I actually did a master's with Stephen F. Austin, completely online. And so I was able to do that and do my day job. And the reason why I did that was because, you know, when I was at university, we didn't have computers. There was one Fortran computer that one person knew how to program in the entire department. And that was it, right? And everything else was, you know, on paper. And so I thought, look, you know, with all these new tools available, I really wanted to experiment firsthand with loading logs into things like Petrel and Kingdom, and then creating, you know, mm-hmm. correlations and cross-sections and producing maps in GIS, you know, and using all of that software technology now that's now available, right? And then also using machine learning and data science to look at, you know, trendology, looking at, you know, using discriminant function mm-hmm. analysis, and so many new things that they just weren't, even 5 years ago, were not yeah. mainstream, right? And yet, you're speaking to, you know, how a person can do a lot more. It's just like any machine, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, when somebody invented the washing machine, it was like, okay, there's a great TED talk where I think it's a Swedish professor talks about how his grandmother, you know, was able to not spend all the time washing the clothes. And so she used that time to read books to her children. And that became part of their sort of academic mm. legacy of education. You know, those are the things that machines allow us to do. They allow us to live a better life, right?
Very, very good point. I was going to make the same point about washing machines, because machines and energy, specifically energy, has given us more free time. And to use the washing example, if you consider looking at people in Southeast Asia still washing clothes along the side of a river, washing, you know, 4 days worth of clothes Whoa. Might be a 3-hour chore. Whereas here in the United States, we throw it in the washing machine and we go read while the machine is doing our work.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Golly.
So that gave us more time to think about other things.
Yeah.
Like podcasts. Yeah.
Right. Now, the accessibility of technology is definitely a real thing. And I can't help but to think if we are saying that a person is getting a lot more efficient at doing anything, finding oil in this particular discussion, we're going to get more efficient, then you must believe that a single well can get more efficient. We should be able to get 20% recovery, 30% recovery, if that's what's going on. We can basically rediscover oil discoveries in dead fields, in fields that they said, man, there's 100 million barrels here, but it just doesn't move. We can't get it to move, and they left it behind. They went and kept at the drill bit. Now let's go back into that thing and get the recoveries
up. That's what brought ROZs, you know, residual oil zones.
Right.
San Andreas. People are exploring those. They're doing horizontal in the ROZs just to get that untapped oil that couldn't be gotten before.
Yeah, James mentioned, you know, 8 or 9% recovery right. in the shales. Well, I'm a conventional player, so I'm drilling sandstone reservoirs largely. And, you know, we're lucky if we can get between 30 and as high as 50% recovery. So there's still a lot of oil left behind in these existing reservoirs, and right. people are using technologies mm-hmm. to get that out. Some of it's electrical stimulation, some of it's chemical stimulation, and even biological stimulation. There are people that will put different critters, excuse the technical term, down the well bore, and that will help loosen the oil up, and they'll pump it out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of this orphaned oil. You know, even there was a guy presenting this week on the Petite Sandstone, and, you know, just simply going back and remapping mm-hmm. with new technology, but literally seeing the play through a new pair of glasses, right? It was like, hey, you know, let's go back in and refract this zone, and it's mm-hmm. producing 80 barrels a day and 1500 mm-hmm. you know, BCF, and it's a good well.
Heck yeah, it's a good well. Yep. It's already drilled and completed. He just went back in and woke it back up. You don't have any of that drilling and completion costs on the economics of that, and you're getting 80 barrels a day.
Yeah,
make a company right there. That's amazing. All right, so let's transition then. If we're talking the future of exploration, and we feel good about technology and supporting this, we feel good about having accessibility, it's cheaper, we can get more powerful, we can get more done, we can cover more area. How what's happening in the future for wildcatters? You know, the guys that are out there, these entrepreneurs that are out there that do have access to cash, they have access to money, and they can spend it, but they don't understand what we're saying. That's what I see personally mm-hmm. when I talk to people like that. They go, I would love to go drill a well, okay, you want to talk about it? You know, drill a well in your backyard. You got to get a lease. You start teaching them this stuff. They're like, whoa, kind of overwhelming. What's the geology? And they're like, whoa, you know, geology is very tricky, but they want it. You know, these wildcatters want that. It's a real thing. And there's so much unlocked money. What do we need to do for the future of wildcatters? What do they need to focus on?
Wow. Well, I'm a wildcatter, and the biggest problem I have is finding people that will invest in drilling deals. Because when I first went into business for myself, I could put a project together and I could sell it. I could get in the doors of even major international oil companies. So I showed deals to Conoco and Exxon. And,
wow.
And they went away when they started leaving the domestic basins. They didn't want to look at my 2 million barrel proposition because they had single wells that produced 2 million barrels as part of a much larger field. And so then we switched to the larger independents, and the medium-sized companies would take our projects.
Mm-hmm.
And then shale was invented, and they all ran to shale because that's where their money source wanted them to go, because you had repeatable experiences there. You could drill a well and complete it, whereas what I do, I'm pretty successful. The averages go up and down, but on average, I hover somewhere between 66 and 75% success. That doesn't mean I won't drill two dry holes in a row. But if you're looking at investors' money, they would. It's like the Price is Right. Bob Barker was a TV show, and you could have the rabbit here, or you could have the toaster, or you could take what was behind door number three.
The new car.
And everybody always wanted to stick with what they had, and I view the people that invest in shale like that. They could invest a dollar and make $1.05 every time, or they could invest in one of my conventional deals, invest a dollar, and maybe make $10. But maybe lose that dollar.
Right.
And most of them said, I'd rather make the 10 cents. And so the medium-sized company disappeared. So now we're down to individual investors and family offices.
Right.
And believe it or not, there are wealthier individuals on the international scene that are willing to invest in domestic oil and gas.
Hmm.
However, our government regulation system is changing to where we are no longer as safe an investment as we once were for those other guys. So my main challenge is finding money to drill the wells. So if you know people, Troy, that are willing to drill, let me know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're drilling a ton. It's shallow wells, you know, not deep wells, you know, but sub 3,000, there's money for that all day long.
Yeah, these are where I'm looking. I've got a shallow well is 5,000 feet, and then I have two other projects right now that I'm marketing that are 13,500 feet.
Wow. So, in the Gulf Coast.
In the Gulf Coast.
Wow.
Yes, people aren't used to having, you know, two dry holes out of three, right? I mean, just hitting like 67, that's exactly what my experience has been too, in conventional. So really there aren't that many true wildcatters. It's the older geologists that live through that true wildcatting. Nowadays, you drill a shale well, it's not about, am I going to get a dry hole? You're always going to get
right.
Well. It's how efficient is it going to risk to reward, right, like you just mentioned. So I see it as there's really not a lot of true wildcatters out there.
Yeah, and there's a lot of potential left out there. Coming to a convention like we're at right now, other people show you their ideas, and and I don't have that idea in my location, but I have something similar.
Yeah.
And there's still a lot of potential left out there if people are willing to go for it.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think speaking about the money aspect of it, I just finished reading a book by John Rotson on the explorer's mindset. None of you guys have read that, but in it, he refers to the fact that in the last decade, the S&P 500 investment fund has gone from double-digit investment in hydrocarbon oil and gas business to low single digits, right? So the public investor community is turning its back on oil and gas. It's kind of like the new tobacco, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yet the returns on investment are very, very good, right? That's why historically it's always been a good business to be in. And you know, that hasn't changed. And so I think one of the biggest challenges is communication.
Mm.
You know, communication at all levels about our business to investors, to governmental authorities to environmental people. You know, there's a lot of education required to get more people comfortable with our business, right? Is what's going to unlock some of the keys, even in terms of carbon sequestration. So you look at some of the new technologies like solar and wind. I mean, there's lots of money being plowed by VC companies into those sort of technologies. But the energy density that you referred to earlier, it's minimal compared to the amount of work in joules of energy that can be produced by a barrel of oil, which is the equivalent of 13 years of a person's work load in joules of energy. It's incredible.
A barrel of oil is equal to 13 years of work power?
Correct, yeah. Art Berman is the guy that speaks a lot about that in terms of, and he, you know, one of the things that he says, which is interesting, is never has a species chosen by design a least dense energy source.
Goes back to that point you were making, how we went from wood to coal to it's doing that because it just makes sense. That's the logical steps. That was nature taking control. It wasn't us controlling that. It was, we were just figuring it out. We continue to do that.
And so one of the things I'm always amazed at is how, I hate to say that we have an ignorant public, but we have an ignorant public when it comes to matters of energy, okay? I take California, for example. I think half the people living there think all you have to do is plug something into the outlet to get the energy. Or an electric car. Electric car doesn't produce any energy. It's running off of the battery, and the battery was charged from the grid, which is either supplied by one of any number of manners. But it's got to be a portable energy.
Yeah, and I think that education needs to start at home, right? I mean, Scott Tinker's speaking next week at the Museum of Natural History and Science next week, and I think it's the 16th. At 6 p.m. And so I bought 4 tickets for my entire family, you know, because I want them to listen to a balanced viewpoint of the future of energy, right? And the more we educate ourselves, the more people to know. I'm quite honored to say that my 18-year-old son Andrew is about to embark on a career as he's going to study geophysics at Texas A&M.
Nice.
You know, because we need new people going into geosciences. Deal. You can tell again, you know, John Olson's presentation, we're declining undergraduate and graduate geologists and petroleum engineers because, you know, the younger folks are turning the back on our industry, right? And so we need more people, more geoscientists coming in and tackling these real challenges in order to provide the energy that the planet's going to need.
And there's no free ride when it comes to energy. So if you're an environmentalist, the bad news is that, you know, windmills, well, there's a whole bunch of issues with them, but specifically I'm talking about when they're decommissioned. So there's a big lawsuit between GE and a company that was going to decommission their blades, and those blades are sitting on 16 acres. They look like beached whales out in West Texas. And solar panels take a lot of farmland out of use. So when we put up an oil well on a farmer's land, we might have maybe once it's producing, if it's on a pump jack and it's depending on how many tanks you need, it might take 2 acres, maybe three, and he can farm the rest of it. But if you put up a solar installation on that guy's farm or gal's farm, whatever, they can't use that land anymore. And so right now, the solar radiation hits the earth and it heats up the earth all day. And at night, when the sun goes down, guess what the earth does? It gives off that solar radiation to moderate the temperature at night. So if you put a solar panel in there, that sunlight is no longer hitting the earth. So we're going to have cooler nights. And guess what? That's going to change the weather patterns eventually somehow as well. And when you talk about people harnessing ocean currents, that scares me the most, because we measure energy in calories, and the calorie is based on water, because water has a very high heat capacity, and that's our standard thing. Hmm. And so if you start taking energy out of the ocean systems, that's going to change the climate too. I mean, there's no free ride. There's just a choice.
That was pretty cool. That was a pretty cool ending to this. Yeah. So to wrap it up, I guess, for the future of exploration, with guys, your experiences and what you have to provide back to the industry and what you do by being here and being on these panels is so huge for the future. How do we do it? We've been talking about it, I think, for years about, you know, these where's the next generation? Why aren't the schools just packed with geologists and engineers who want to fight this energy demand and climate change, right? And how do we better understand the climate so we get an idea of what it's changing and why it's changing, not call it a crisis, but figuring out what's really going on. We've been talking about it. You hear that. You hear this effort for years, right? What's missing? So that's how we'll end it. What's missing to fuel the exploration, the future of exploration?
Well, I think from my perspective, an honest conversation between the media that gets points out to the general population and the scientific community. And part of that goes back to the government too, because if you're a researcher in college, part of your mission is to bring research dollars in so your department can continue.
Right.
And if I'm a PhD researcher at, let's say, UT or A&M, whatever, and I say I want to investigate, you know, some chemical additive to get more oil out of this reservoir. And then my coworker, another PhD, he's submitting a grant and he wants to investigate better lubricants for windmill. Guess who's going to get the government money? The guy with better lubricants for the windmill. But really, the government needs to get its hand out of the pie and back into the private citizen and the capitalist system. That's my view. A little politics, sorry about that.
It's almost turned into a whole podcast here, but what do you think, Mr. Toner? How do you do it?
Yeah, no, look, I mean, I think it's...
Well, you are doing it. Your kid's going to be a geophysicist.
Yeah.
You know, you raised a young man that said, you know what, Dad, I'm going to do this. You know, so you're doing it. How'd you do it?
Just by talking, you know, talking at home over the dinner table, telling him about, you know, watching podcasts like Switch by, you know, Scott Tinker, talking about energy, kind of debunking, demything a lot of the things that you hear in mainstream media, right, and talking about real things. And but it is going to require a lot of effort, right? I think, you know, Scott calls it join us in the radical middle, where stuff gets done, right? Because it's going to require a lot of interaction. You know, we need politicians with vision, you know, to begin with. Like where are we going? Where are we going to be in 20 years from now? Yeah, that's what we need. You know, people saying this is where this country's going, and we can get something we can get behind. Right. That starts with that.
Without being scared to get there.
Yeah.
I mean, all the politicians, regardless of your political stripe, use scare tactics to motivate their clients, so to speak.
Yeah. And you know, I also think, you know, there's a whole the whole aspect of extraterrestrial. We haven't even talked about exploration, right? You know. Solar satellites, in terms of, okay, you know, where can we harness solar where it doesn't impact the Earth like it is based on, you know, the what you described, Barry. I think there's opportunities there. I mean, there's the whole helium-3 thing on the moon with nuclear fusion and, you know, lots of interesting things, right, to be tackled that are even beyond, you know, what we're currently even, you know. One thing's for sure is, you know, I've heard this said before, you know, we didn't come out of the Stone Age because we ran out of stones.
Humans have been altering the environment ever since the first human came down from the tree and went into a cave and evicted a bear. And then they built a lean-to when the caves got full. So, I mean, progress is the way into the future, always.
Well, so for me, I would say communication, because you asked, you know, a question about.
Yeah.
You know, so I definitely think it's communication, and I think it kind of starts with the geological societies.
Right.
In West Texas, we have a very good program where we go to the schools and we educate the students. We give geology talks. We judge their science fairs. Mm-hmm. We are active in Boy Scouts and teach geology, and also in the Girl Scouts, Indian Princesses, we do it there. And we set up field trips, and we'll invite the public to come to these field trips for the kids, and we'll go out and look at rocks or look at some fossils or do something. So I think it starts with educating you know, not just the city or your you know, your what's around you, but also the schools and the kids.
Yeah, and in Houston, the Geological Society and SIPES, which is another organization, and probably the Geophysical Society does it too, will visit elementary schools and talk to the kids. I like to go on career days to different elementary schools and talk about geology and petroleum and in general. And the last person to walk on the moon, by the way, was a geologist.
The last person to walk on the moon. Now, what's his name again?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
I should know his name.
Schmidt, Harrison Schmidt.
Schmidt.
Yeah.
And he's involved with getting helium-3 off the.
Oh, moon is he right the one too. That's?
He's they're linked to the space. Okay. I've talked to those folks. It's pretty interesting.
Man, well, I guess the last thing is I don't want it to go unnoticed. Is the sponsors from oil and gas companies that come back and invest in these events? You know, like the gold sponsors are Chevron and Oxy, and I'm forgetting one. But anyway, I think that's super, super important for all the service companies to be recognized and all the operators that are actually putting money back into these events to make it possible that we have somewhere to meet. I mean, there's no way us four would have ever gotten together for the rest of our time. And I could even offer you guys, like, pay you guys to come and let's get together on this day and let's talk about this. It would have never happened. The only way it happened is because the AAPG volunteers, the STGS, right? These professionals that really understand that commitment and that investment back into the career and the future. The future of exploration is, what is our investment right now? We can sit and talk about it all day, but are we investing right now as much as we can while still making a living and being comfortable into the next 20 years? We got to do that. And I thank you guys for being on this panel discussion and doing that.
Thank you.
Thank you
for your time. Thanks.